KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles and online for the world at kpfk.org.
You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara County, and across the globe at kpfk.org. Pacifica Radio for all the surfing, California and beyond.
Well, good afternoon. Good afternoon, and welcome. Welcome to this week's edition of the Lawyers Guild Show. I'm Jim Laffey, along with my friend and co-host, Maria Hall. Maria, it's good to see you.
Yes, good to see you too. Good to hear your voice, and I'm enjoying my KPFK mug here and having a little tea since it's nice and cool today.
Yes, well, that's a good plug for the fun drive.
It is.
Don't go away, friends. We're going to spend maybe 5 minutes in the whole show talking about why you need to give us a call. But you do need to give us a call. That's why we extended the fun drive just 3 days, I think, because we fell a little short. We thank all of you who contributed. Those of you that haven't yet but meant to, now's your chance. All you have to do is give us a call at 818-985-5735, and you can... Oh, you can go online and pick at kpfk.org and pick out a lot of ways we say thank you. We like to think the programming here at KPFK is thanks enough, but we add a little something to it. So check out all the ways that we have of sending you premium gifts in response to your pledges. But do please pledge whatever you can afford. 818-985-5735. You can give a call. There are people waiting for your call. In the meanwhile, we can introduce the show and get started. Because this week on the Lawyers Guild Show, we're going to once again spend the entire hour reviewing some of the more important court decisions, court cases flowing from the actions and policies of the Trump administration. And we're also going to spend some time of the hour taking a look at the more important cases on this fall's term, which just opened, of the Supreme Court. And among the cases to be considered there are a bathroom dispute involving a transgender boy, Harvard University and $2 billion, the matter of the unitary executive theory, Trump's desire to fire Lisa Cook, and a case where a judge has ordered the Trump administration to give UCLA back $5 million. All of that, plus today, just today, the Supreme Court heard arguments on what's left of the Voting Rights Act in a case over black representation and redistricting. Well, we've got a lot to cover. Let's get started. Our guest for today's show is, of course, Stephen Rohde, who is always our go-to guest when we're considering the work of the courts. Now, Mr. Rohde is a prolific author of 2 books, scores of articles, book reviews on constitutional law and history. He's the former president of the ACLU Foundation of Southern California and is special advisor on free speech and the First Amendment for the Muslim Public Affairs Council. Steve Rohde is also a host of his own new podcast, Speaking Freely, produced by MS Studios, which is available on Spotify, iHeartRadio, and other streaming platforms. I should also mention, of course, that Mr. Rohde is also, along with Maria Hall and myself, a host on the National Public Affairs show known as Law and Disorder, now airing in close to 165 radio markets all across the nation. Well, Steve Rohde, a warm welcome back to the Lawyers Guild Show.
Thank you, Jim. It's a pleasure personally to be with you and Maria, even though we're talking about some very distressing events that are going on in the Supreme Court and elsewhere.
Oh boy, are we ever. Well, Steve, let's get right started. I know you feel that one of the most important cases is the case of AAUP versus Rubio. That's where a judge has ruled that Trump unlawfully targeted non-citizens over their pro-Palestinian speech. Well, talk to us about this case and why you think it's so important.
Well, I wanted to start today's program with this case of AAUP versus Rubio, because it is actually the first case in the last 9 months of the Trump administration in which a court case has gone all the way through trial. In this case, in Boston, in a case brought by the American Association of University Professors, represented by the Knight First Amendment Institute at Columbia University, in July, they had a full dress trial before Judge William G. Young. 15 witnesses were called, scores of documents were introduced. And now on September 30, Judge Young issued a 181-page opinion upholding the claims of the AAUP that the Trump administration had, through a policy of arresting, detaining, and deporting non-citizen students and faculty members for their pro-Palestinian advocacy, that all violates the First Amendment. Mm-hmm. This is important, excuse me, because earlier court rulings, and there have been hundreds of TROs and injunctions against Trump and what he and his minions have been doing. This is after a full dress detailed trial and now a full court opinion. What the case exposed was that the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency and the State Department under Marco Rubio had formed a tiger team to investigate alleged individuals, foreign students and professors, who posed a risk, as they see it, to the United States because of their ideology. The Tiger Team relied on a rather nefarious website called the Canary Mission, which is a right-wing pro-Israel website that catalogs student, faculty, and others whom it deems to be engaging in anti-Israel speech. And the testimony showed that the government was virtually exclusively relying on this right-wing website to target students and faculty. And it was the accumulation of that evidence that led Judge William Young to issue his order. It's important to note that Judge Young was nominated by President Ronald Reagan and has served on the court for over 40 years. Despite that, the Trump administration has trashed Judge Young and belittled his opinion. This one is strong. It's well documented. I hope it will be upheld by the First Circuit Court of Appeals that covers Boston. And frankly, I hold out some hope that because of how it's documented and how it's based on the First Amendment, that even the conservative members of the Supreme Court may well uphold this judgment.
Let's hope. Yes, indeed.
Well, speaking of the U.S. Supreme Court, it's now ruled on the restrictions that a judge had imposed on L.A. immigration stops after the agents swept up U.S. citizens in their raids, and also ruled on Trump's deployment of National Guard troops. How did they rule in these two cases?
Yeah, this is very troubling because, once again, you had a full dress hearing in which the ACLU and attorney Mohammed Tajjar represented the protesters. And the court found, the trial court, that the ICE agents were using illegitimate factors in order to decide who to arrest and detain. They were using the apparent race or ethnicity of an individual, whether they spoke Spanish or English with an accent, whether they were present in a particular location, like a bus stop or car wash or agricultural site, and the type of work they did. The trial court had found all of those improper grounds on which to arrest and detain a person under long-standing Supreme Court and other precedent. And yet, the U.S. Supreme Court intervened, and on September 8, they issued a stay, temporarily pausing that injunction, which the trial court had issued. This is very troubling because, as we may expand on throughout the hour, this was the use of the shadow docket, a brief and quick review of the case, with six of the justices voting to lift this injunction. There was virtually no rationale by the majority. Justice Kavanaugh did issue a 10-page concurrence, which was rather boilerplate in terms of the law, but didn't apply the law to these facts. Justice Sotomayor issued a dissent on behalf of herself and Justices Kagan and Jackson, a 21-page dissent. Fundamentally, she found this to be a grave misuse of our emergency docket, because they had not justified a likelihood of the government succeeding or that the balance of injury tipped in favor of the government. This, along with the other case you mentioned, is serious because we know that ICE is feeling emboldened when it gets this kind of blanket protection from the Supreme Court. And so it's attempting to move into other cities such as Portland and Chicago and Washington, D.C. This is a prime example of the Supreme Court intervening, disrupting the status quo when injunctions are meant to maintain the status quo.
Indeed. Well, another couple of cases. Steve, a judge has ordered Trump now to give UCLA back $5 million. And another lower court judge ordered the Trump administration to give Harvard back over $2 billion. Talk to us about these two cases.
Yeah, these are important because, you know, the work has to be done at the trial level. That's where the evidence is adduced. That's where the witnesses testify. And it was very important that on September 22nd, U.S. District Judge Rita Lynn in San Francisco granted a preliminary injunction saying that the government had likely violated the Administrative Procedures Act, which requires specific procedures and explanations for federal funding cuts. And instead, the government had told UCLA, just in a generalized form letter, that multiple grants would be suspended. It was done under this spreading and nefarious theory that UCLA had failed to combat anti-Semitism and instead followed affirmative action. And Judge Lynn ruled that as a result, $81 million in grants from the National Science Foundation were being restored to UCLA, as well as other grants as well. I apologize to your listeners. I have a little chalky throat today. Mm-hmm. The judge was in contrast to Ivy League institutions like Columbia and Brown, which have capitulated to these grounds, to these orders by the Trump administration. Monday's ruling concerned hundreds of medical research grants from the National Institutes of Health that include studies into Parkinson's disease treatment, cancer recovery, cell regeneration in nerves, and other areas that campus leaders had argued are pivotal in improving the health of Americans. I pause there to give some of those details because sometimes we lose track of the human lives that are at stake in these grants. We feel it's rather ethereal and remote to talk about billions of dollars of grants, but it's real people whose lives are being affected as is true so much in what Trump is doing. Now, this parallels an earlier decision involving Harvard, in which U.S. District Judge Allison Burroughs in Boston, in an 84-page opinion, restored $2.2 billion of grants that had been suspended to Harvard. And she was quite explicit in saying that the anti-Semitism rationale did not hold in this case. She said, we must fight against anti-Semitism, but we equally need to protect our rights, including the right to free speech, and neither goal should or needs to be sacrificed on the altar of the other. That's an emerging view in some of the lower courts, which I think is valid, and I was pleased to see those two lower court rulings.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed.
Well, Steve, another Supreme Court ruling had to do with a transgender boy wanting to use the boys' bathroom at school. How did the court rule in that case?
Well, this was interesting because here the court actually allowed a lower court ruling to go forward in a controversial area in the law these days. This was a case out of South Carolina where a federal appeals court had required South Carolina to allow a transgender student to use the boys' bathroom while the teen's challenge to a state law that requires students to use the bathroom that corresponds to their biological sex, quote, at the time of birth, continues. Now, the order was unsigned, the Supreme Court order. It does mean that at least five and perhaps six of the justices agreed to allow that order to go forward. However, Justices Clarence Thomas, Samuel Alito, and Neil Gorsuch all said that they would have granted the state's request to stay that lower court ruling. The lower courts had found that the state law violates the Constitution's Equal Protection Clause, which requires the government to treat similarly situated people the same, as well as federal civil rights laws barring gender discrimination. It only applies to this one student, which may have been appealing to the conservatives that it was not a broader order. But it is some glimmer of hope that there are certain areas in which the Supreme Court, even the conservative majority, in this case, will allow that injunction to go forward. Mr. Judge Kavanaugh indicated that he emphasized that it was not coming out on the merits of the challenge. Now, we don't know what the court will do when that's fully argued on the merits.
Yes. Well, another two interesting cases and important cases of late. Judges have ruled against Trump's gender ideology order in one case involving teen pregnancy and another endowment for the arts. Tell us about those two cases and why we felt they were important.
Yeah. In the first of those cases, a federal judge, Beryl Howell in New York, found that requiring federal teen pregnancy prevention grants to comply with Trump's orders, which curtailed what he called radical indoctrination and, quote, gender ideology, that his orders were restrained. This was a victory for Planned Parenthood and their affiliates in California, Iowa, and New York, which had sued to block the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, which had issued this protocol in July. In her written ruling, the trial judge found that that administration policy was, quote, motivated solely by political concerns, devoid of any considered process or analysis, and it was ignorant of the statutory emphasis on evidence-based programming. So here we see lower courts pushing back, not accepting Trump's effort to impose a ideological test on these pregnancy prevention grants. And in a parallel case, the National Endowment of the Arts, which is now in under the full control of Trump, had demanded that arts endowment grants be judged by whether they complied with Trump's gender ideology order. In March, several arts organizations, including the Rhode Island Latino Arts Group and the National Queer Theater, had challenged the law. The law had said that grants shall not be used to promote gender ideology. Gender ideology is this shorthand that Trump is using when groups are attempting to advance, in this case, the art of Latinos or of the National Queer Theater. Mm-hmm. And luckily, the judges are seeing through this. Judge William E. Smith, a different judge, senior district judge appointed by Bush, noted that the law ensures that grants are based on talent alone, irrespective of the artist's viewpoint or message that are conveyed in their works. Whereas the Trump administration wants to go down the road of imposing their viewpoints, the law says artists should be judged on their merits. Frankly, Trump speaks about judging things on the merits, but not when it comes to this. So two cases, very parallel and consistent. And again, we're hopeful they will be upheld on appeal.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's almost time for our station break, but I think we have time perhaps to do justice to the next question, Maria.
Sure. Steve, we wanted to ask you about a case where oral arguments were heard this morning. It's a case out of Louisiana involving the Voting Rights Act and Black representation. What can you tell us about this case?
Well, breaking news here on the Lawyers Guild show. This case was argued only a few hours ago in Washington, D.C. It's a case called Louisiana versus Callis. And it's a test of the Section 2 of the 1965 Voting Act, Voting Rights Act. Now, we had all thought that combating racial discrimination in voting was part of the fabric of American society, was a pillar of our advancement from the Civil Rights Movement. But the Roberts Court has consistently been chipping away at the Voting Rights Act. We may remember that in 2013, Roberts presided and wrote the opinion in Shelby County, which gutted a crucial section of the Voting Rights Act itself. Roberts has had this act in his sights for years, going back to when he was in the Republican administrations as a lawyer. On Wednesday, the arguments did not go well for sustaining the Voting Rights Act, which has lasted for all of these 80 years. Conservative judges on the court peppered the lawyers with questions. What they did is they're suggesting that race no longer be taken into consideration because somehow current conditions show that we have reached a colorblind society and we no longer need laws of this kind. Well, in the questioning, Justices Sotomayor, Kagan, and Jackson shot back. They pointed out that these cases in the lower courts was based on current evidence of racial disparities in the mapping and the voter maps and the congressional maps used, that this was not based on outdated evidence. It was based on current evidence. When I reflected on this case, and I'm very troubled by the oral argument this morning, it seems like this Republican majority doesn't think you can take race into consideration in these cases. Well, how can we fight racial discrimination without taking race into consideration? It is, after all, race that led to the discrimination in the first place, and you have to acknowledge those racial considerations when you combat it. This would be like fighting cancer without taking malignant tumors into consideration. It's a ridiculous approach, but it gains traction among Republican circles, and I'm very worried that 5 or 6 justices will either strike down the Voting Rights Act in this case, or at least send it back to the court to judge the Voting Rights Act by a higher standard, which may inevitably lead to cutting back on the efforts to combat racial discrimination in voting.
And in fact, it's interesting to note that in Louisiana, the state involved in this particular made no secret about it. I mean, it wasn't as though they just were drawing symmetrical districts for representation in the Congress. They purposely and knowingly and rather admittedly drafted these districts in such a way as to disenfranchise the black voters of the state. The notion that race is not playing a role in this is by the justices kind of putting their head in the sand, isn't it?
Yes, and it's part of this emboldened Republican majority, and we will talk about this a little in the next segment. John Roberts is doing the job for which he was appointed originally, and for which he has pledged fealty to the Republican platform. He is marching through the Republican agenda in all fields, and in this case, voting rights. And he is using the court to sustain what they cannot win when popular majorities support the Voting Rights Act, support reproductive freedom, support gun control. And instead, he and his colleagues are using the court to achieve what they're not achieving with the public.
That's right. And in fact, in an article in the New York Times this morning, commenting on the case and the likely outcome of the case, made the point that if it rules as we fear the court will rule, you're talking about a dozen or a dozen and a half more Republican members of the House of Representatives. It's just that simple. So he is definitely doing that dirty work. Well, we will now pause for station ID. We'll be right back with you shortly, my friends, so go nowhere.
As a KPFK listener, you expect to hear smart conversations about important issues every time you turn on the radio. We bring you facts and analysis, not partisanship or hype, so you can form your own opinions on the news. You count on KPFK for informed, insightful reporting. Don't take coverage like this for granted. It's here for you, thanks to the generous financial support of our listeners. Support the programming you rely on right now by calling 818-985-5735 or contribute online at kpfk.org.
And we are right back with you. That was the short ID break. We're right back with you, my friends. You're listening to the Lawyers Guild Show. I'm Jim Lafferty, along with Maria Hall, co-host of the show. And we have Steve Rohde with us because he's our go-to guy when we're talking about what the courts have been up to. And there's been a lot they've been up to. Most of it is not very pleasing to at least those of us here on the Lawyers Guild Show. And let me just quickly say that we have extended our fund drive by a few days because we're falling a little short. Don't go anywhere. I'm just going to spend the next 30 seconds or so reminding you that if you haven't already contributed, we'd sure appreciate you do that. And do it during our show, if you would. That's kind of nice. We kind of get brownie points for it, and that's always good. Makes you feel good. We know that the listeners are out there enjoy the show. I run into people all the time who listen to the show and tell us how much they enjoy it. So please do, if you could. And Steve's holding up something. Yeah. No, Steve Rohde, what are you holding up, my friend?
Well, I'm holding up the premium I got for a donation to KPFK, the book, The Trial of Socrates, by I.F. Stone, one of the muckraking journalists I most have respected over all of my years. I was delighted to see the trial of Socrates was a premium. There are many other wonderful premiums, including Maria's coffee mug. None of this was solicited. I think my remarks are coming as a surprise to you guys. But I believe in KPFK, and I want this platform where I can talk about these Supreme Court cases and the important issues of the day. You're not going to find a one-hour examination of these court cases the way you do and in all the programming that you hear on KPFK. So that's my unsolicited endorsement.
Well, we thank you for that, Steve, and you're absolutely right, of course. This is a very unique station. This isn't what you're going to hear on the corporate media. And we don't take sponsors. Archer Daniels Midland is not sponsoring our shows and so forth and so on. So it's just you, my friends. Go to the website, kpfk.org. Look at the many ways we say thank you when you contribute. Contribute as much as you can. Think about some of the folks who are listening and we want them to keep listening, who are out of work right now and can't really afford to make a pledge. Make a double pledge. Make a pledge for yourself and throw something in for those who can't, because they want you to contribute too. 818-985-5735. All right, Maria, let's start off with the second half of the show. We've got a lot of good cases yet, important cases, not necessarily good cases to cover.
Right, yeah. And just to piggyback off of what you both said about KPFK, yes, I love my KPFK mugs, so I do try to give each time, and then I can get a whole set. But more importantly, here in Los Angeles, we are one of the ground zero points, and we really need to be able to use our airwaves, you know, as these immigration raids go on and as the Olympics come. We really need to come together as a community and have these airwaves. Okay, so Steve Rohde, Trump and his supporters have been using this unitary executive theory of the presidency. And it may sound daunting to if people haven't heard that before, but please bear with us because it's super important. So they're kind of using that to support Trump's efforts to take on vast new powers, like, for example, trying to remove Lisa Cook from the Federal Reserve Board, which we talked about here on our show a couple weeks ago. So does it appear to you that the Supreme Court may be prepared to adopt this unitary executive theory, and please tell us what that means, in ruling on this case, and what will that mean for future power grabs by Trump?
Yes, it's worth taking a few minutes because this unitary executive theory pervades the cases that are coming up with Trump in power, and it undergirds a whole range of cases that the Supreme Court has heard and is hearing this year. So I think it's important to examine it, to understand it, and why it is so dangerous. For the life of the United States, based on the Constitution, we understood separation of powers, that there were three, they sometimes are called co-equal branches, and that there were checks and balances, one branch against the other. That was the concept of the founders. The founders got some things right. They got a lot of things wrong in terms of perpetuating slavery and discrimination. But the structure of the U.S. government was driven by Enlightenment thinking and a reaction to the tyranny of European governments, including the British government. So the court had looked at laws passed over the years that Congress passed, which had an impact on the executive branch, and in particularly the development over time of independent administrative agencies. We now have an entire structure of the Federal Trade Commission, the Consumer Protection Bureau, the Federal Reserve Bank, all created by Congress as independent agencies. And the Supreme Court consistently has ruled until very recently that those laws are constitutional, and those laws limited the president's power to remove commissioners from these independent agencies. They would require a cause, or they would require dereliction of duty or some form of abuse before a commissioner could be removed. Well, systematically, since the Reagan administration, the Republican wing of the court has tried to undermine those principles. There was one point at which only Justice Scalia was a lone dissenter, while the rest of the court was upholding the independence of these agencies. It all goes back most recently to a case now 90 years old called Humphrey's Executor versus the United States. And unfortunately, in that case, FDR tried to fire a member of the Federal Trade Commission, and the Supreme Court unanimously slapped down FDR, but they put on the law books a very important case that such a commissioner could only be removed for good cause. Since then, in tandem with this development, in the Reagan administration and thereafter, law professors, conservative law professors, saw that they needed to bolster the executive branch. They felt that with the Electoral College and with small states having equal power with large states, that they had a very good chance of electing Republican presidents, even despite the popular vote or the will of the people. And that strategy has been proving true in the election of a whole series of Republican presidents up to Trump. So the Republican theory was, let's bolster the president. Let's conceive of a theory, and it was just a theory. It's not based on the Constitution. There's nothing in the Constitution that says that the President of the United States is superior over all other branches of the government. In fact, it says the President can recommend legislation to Congress, then Congress can judge that legislation for itself. Yet, slowly and incrementally, with the expansion of the now six-member conservative majority, this unitary executive theory, which says that Congress cannot impinge on the president's power, even by requiring good cause for the removal of a previously approved commissioner. There have now been at least four cases in the last 9 months in which Trump has fired independent commissioners. And guess what? They're all Democrats. Yeah. All of the commissioners he's fired are Democrats, and the lower courts have granted injunctions to restore those individuals to their jobs pending the outcome of the litigation. And consistently, the Supreme Court's six-member majority has granted stays of those injunctions. These cases, they're called Wilcox and Boyle and Slaughter, will be heard. The court has set one of them for oral argument in December of this year, next month. Now, one interesting aberration was the Lisa Cook case involving the Federal Reserve Board. There is some belief that because of the structure of the Federal Reserve Board, that ultimately the court may carve out an exception to this Republican theory that the president has unfettered authority to fire commissioners. And so in this case, the Lisa Cook, a Democrat governor of the Federal Reserve Board, who was fired without cause by Trump, she sued, she won a preliminary injunction, and the court has set October 1st for oral argument. So what they're doing is putting the case on a fast track rather than granting a stay. And we will see what happens on October 1st. And I can promise you, if you invite me back, I will talk about that oral argument, whether there's a ruling in it or not. All of this is important because it bolsters the approach of so many observers, including myself, that if the court can undermine Congress, and it's doing it always by dismantling the Department of Education and other parts of it, then it will neuter Congress. And if you have control of the Supreme Court, you have neutered Congress, and you have a superior, powerful president, then there can virtually be no guardrails that are going to protect the rest of us.
Well, and following up on that, Steve, you're so right. Following up on that, this term also finds the Supreme Court ruling on Trump's assumption of the power to set the rate of tariffs, which have traditionally been a congressional prerogative. What's your prediction or what you're thinking about that case?
Yes, on November 5th, the justices will hear oral arguments in the case of Learning Resources, Inc. versus Trump and a companion case over whether Trump had the legal authority to impose tariffs on goods from foreign countries. The fact that this was litigated is surprising because there is a special court created by the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, an act of Congress. It has multiple members, I believe, something on the order of a dozen judges serve on that court. And a few months ago, kind of out of the blue, everybody was thinking, well, Trump's tariffs could be questioned as a policy issue. They could be questioned for imposing taxes on American citizens, etc. But here, this court found that the tariffs unilaterally imposed by Trump were illegal. And they stayed their own decision pending Supreme Court review. Now, these massive tariffs have disrupted our economy. They've imposed a secret tax on the American people, although Trump acts like they are some kind of windfall paid for by foreign governments. Mm-hmm. So I'm interested. The court has taken the case, but in their hands, and I don't think I'm cynical here. I think I'm realistic. They could find different avenues either to send that case back and lift the order or find outright that Congress has intruded on the president's powers by passing this International Emergency Economic Powers Act. So that's set for oral argument on November 5. And I'll be tracking it for you and everybody else.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed.
Well, we appreciate that. I know it's a lot of homework you do. You actually read the cases, not just the sound bites. Well, in this Supreme Court term, meaning the real term, not the shadow docket, which we'll be talking about in a moment, on October 7th, there was an argument on a case challenging states' restrictions on conversion therapy. And that is the idea that a non-heterosexual person can be, quote unquote, converted into someone who is heterosexual. Talk to us about this case.
Yes. This is of concern because the Supreme Court took this case. They had oral arguments on October 7, only about a week ago. Now, this was a case brought by a counselor, Kaylee Childs, in Colorado, in which, as a therapist, she challenged a statute that Colorado had passed known as the Minor Conversion Therapy Law in 2019. Colorado was very concerned, and it described the law as a response to a growing mental health crisis among Colorado teenagers and mounting evidence that conversion therapy is associated with increased depression anxiety, suicidal thoughts, and suicide attempts. The law bars mental health professionals from providing clients under the age of 18 with conversion therapy to kind of manipulate them and coerce them based contrary to their own instincts and their own desire to examine their gender identity. The law only applies to those persons over the age of 18, and it does carve out an exception, which the exception is for a practice of religious ministry. That always troubles me, that we carve out these exceptions, that apparently what is terrible and worth a statute when it applies to anybody else and any other counselor of a young person or an adult, the religious ministries get a free pass on that. But putting that aside, because this particular case doesn't raise that exception, a federal trial judge in Colorado turned down a request for an order that would have temporarily barred the state from implementing this ban on conversion therapy. But then the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 10th Circuit upheld, let me be sure I've said that right to your audience. The trial judge did grant a bar on the implementation of that law, and this is a double negative. So the point is, the trial court allowed the law prohibiting conversion therapy to stand, and that was upheld by the 10th Circuit. They found that this is a ordinary regulation of medical and therapeutic treatment, which is conduct, and it only has an incidental effect on the therapist's speech. As a result, they use the rational basis standard. Well, back on October 7, the case was argued before the court. There was a variety of questioning by the judges. Ironically, Justice Brett Kavanaugh, who could be a swing vote on this, asked no questions at the oral argument. Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson noted that there's a long history of regulating medical treatments, and that it would be very odd to carve out an exception in this case. She pointed out that many medical treatments include words, and just because something includes words doesn't mean that is free speech when you are a licensed medical practitioner. We know that many areas of our law includes words, but they are still regulated. Securities and SEC regulations include words. Law practices include words. Crimes include words, but that doesn't mean that any of those areas cannot suitably and reasonably be regulated by a particular state. As might be expected, Justice Samuel Alito pushed back, and of all things, he questioned whether there is any support for opposition to conversion therapy. Okay. He cited an era in which medical professionals believed that children with Down syndrome should be placed in an institution shortly after birth. Well, we know that medical science has stumbled along the way. But we also know that under current analysis, the notion of using therapy to contort and reverse a patient's interest in their gender identity is not the same as the laws concerning Down syndrome. So it was argued there may be some chance that it'll be sent back to the lower courts for review under a more strict standard. And some of the progressives on the court may have been hoping for that result to avoid an outright ruling in this area. But it's an important case because it was just argued, and it's one we have to watch carefully.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. The therapist in that case, by the way, made I thought, a rather specious free speech argument, but be that as it may. I want to get at least one other case in because it's an important case, and that, Steve, is the matter of birthright citizenship. You know, under the 14th Amendment, it's going to be argued before the court this term as well, and it would seem the language of the amendment is quite clear, but I wonder, is it really that simple a case?
It's a very important case. In one challenge that only brought up the nationwide injunctions, that was Trump versus CASA earlier in June, they ducked the merits of the challenges to birthright citizenship. But now cases have arisen in several states, and this may very well be before the court. On September 26th, the Solicitor General, this is Trump's Solicitor General now, asked the Supreme Court to review two cases arising out of the First and Ninth Circuits that had declared Trump's executive order on birthright citizenship to be unconstitutional. There are cases going back to 1898 in which the Supreme Court held that the 14th Amendment means what it says. All persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. That was meant at the time to address and reverse and ensure citizenship to slaves and former enslaved people. But cases throughout the history of the court have upheld that we are a country that depends on birth, and a child born in the United States, irrespective of the citizenship of his or her parents, is a citizen of the United States. Trump's executive order, as soon as he came into office, the very day he was sworn in, he issued an executive order saying that only children of citizens or parents with green cards are U.S. citizens. This is a frontal attack on a key provision of American law and American Constitution. I am hopeful that there are not five votes. I don't think we would probably give up Gorsuch, Alito, and Thomas, but the Chief Justice has his reputation on the line, as do the two Trump appointees. We will watch this case, and assuming it is set for oral argument, we'll cover the arguments as well.
All right, thank you for that. Well, Maria, let's at least start the discussion on the next point, maybe. We can get a little bit of it. Steve can give us a quick interpretation and explain how things work.
Sure, sure. We just wanted to clarify for listeners about the, now that the Supreme Court is in its quote unquote regular session, have you clarify about the difference between the emergency or shadow docket, these cases that they rule on, and why they're so important and why they're getting in some more controversial rulings than, you know, these reasoned decisions that are coming out, hopefully, this term.
Yes. Of course, let's be watch out what you ask for, because we could get reasoned opinions that tear down the Constitution as well. So this is going to be a very difficult year ahead. And I think the fact that you devote time on this show to these cases is very important. Because as much as we are going to be in the streets, October 18 is No King's Day. I've said on this program that these lawsuits, these injunctions are crucial and necessary, but they are not sufficient, that it is we the people as every major movement in American history, from the anti-slavery movement to the women's movement, the civil rights movement, the labor movement, the LGBTQ movement, has always been fueled and driven by the people in their public demonstration of support for the democracy and the Constitution. But meanwhile, and for these 9 months in the first period of time, Roberts drove this shadow docket. Now, it's understandable that the Supreme Court needs an emergency docket. I often mention the death penalty cases. If someone's on the verge of being executed and there are serious questions about his or her conviction, you certainly don't want the person executed before you can hear the case on the merits. So emergency cases have their place in the law. But what the Roberts Court and this super conservative majority has done is turn this on its head, because the status quo on January 19 was all of the laws that Congress passed, all of the independent agencies we've talked about, that was the status quo. Trump disrupted the status quo beginning in January, and these court rulings have been an effort to maintain the status quo until the case could be heard on the merits. And instead, in at least 20 important cases, the U.S. Supreme Court has granted these emergency stays. They've been issued, and as you say, I read everything. One was one paragraph in which it summarized the proceedings, this court, that court, and didn't even talk about the issue, didn't talk about the merits, didn't find a likelihood that the government would prevail, didn't find a likelihood that the balance of equities tipped in favor of the government, justifying a stay. They did none of that. It was left to the dissenters in long, careful, comprehensive dissents. So now we're facing the merits, although they're still granting some of these emergency stays. And now we're going to have to confront the question, when they argue these cases and issue full dress opinions, have they been hiding behind the shadow docket? Have they been able to toss Trump a bone during his honeymoon months to give him a little sway to start off his administration? Or really, do they believe in each and every one of these cases that they are going to undermine separation of powers, undermine the rule of law, undermine independent agencies? That's really the challenge of the docket and the term of the Supreme Court we have before us. And that's why I'm so grateful we cover these cases on your show.
Yeah, I would just point out in response to your hypothetical question, the according again to the New York Times, the number of cases that this Supreme Court considered in this shadow document, you know, where there's no benefit of argument and briefing and what have you, in just the first 9 months of Trump's presidency, is equal to all of the shadow document cases decided in the presidencies of the last four or five presidents throughout their entire four-year terms added together. So it's an extraordinary use of it that we're witnessing now, which is why we're talking about it here on the Lawyers Guild Show. We do have just a minute or so left. I'm not quite sure how much time we have left for sure, but our engineer will sure let us know. That's just enough time for me, first of all, Steve, to thank you. Please tell us quickly where people can follow your work.
Well, I'm very pleased to be writing for LA Progressive and Truth Out and Truth Dig as well. But I discovered recently that muckrake.com has automatically collected all my articles, and folks can go to muckrake.com and search for Stephen Rohde.
All right, wonderful. Well, I'm afraid that's going to do it for us as we go off the air, friends. You give a call at 818-985-5735. Let us know you support this unique station, and we think this unique Lawyers Guild show as well.
Yeah, and there's only 3 hours left, I think, of the pledge drive, and there are some amazing thank you gifts. I just got mine.
Oh, good, good.
So if you're one that waits till the last minute like I do, please. go on right now, kpfk.org, and we're out of time.
All right. Until next week at the same time, my friends. Thank you so much for listening today to the Lawyers Guild Show. This is Jim Lafferty on behalf of myself and Maria Hall. Thank you, urging you to stay healthy. And as the song is about to tell you, to make sure that you continue to stand up for your rights, my friends. It's a that needs our exposure.